KQED.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation, improving the lives of California's children, the California Healthcare Foundation, and Cal Hospital Compare, rating hospital quality in California, on the web at calhospitalcompare.org, and URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. URSCorp.com.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. Coming up, now that the Southland fires are contained, fire victims ponder the future. Can you ever go home again? Plus, what it takes to make a house fireproof.
It's like a little plug that stops birds from going up and nesting underneath your tile, but it also will stop the little burning bits from blowing in underneath and catching your rooftop on fire.
Also, we'll visit a California orchard where you can harvest your own chestnuts, recipes included, and not for the faint of heart, butchering your own meat.
Well, before it kind of looked like a wild animal, and now it looks like something I'd see in a butcher shop. It's all tied up and ready to go.
I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is the California Report. Fire officials in Southern California are asking the public for help. They're trying to figure out what sparked the Southland fires that destroyed hundreds of homes and burned thousands of acres in Los Angeles, Orange, Riverside, and San Bernardino counties this past week. The Oak Ridge Mobile Home Park in the Sylmar area of the San Fernando Valley took the hardest hit. No one died there, but nearly 500 homes at the park were destroyed. Park residents spent this week sifting through the rubble. While many are pledging to rebuild their homes, they're not sure their community will ever feel the same again. Sarah Varney reports.
The park's wooden guardhouse looks untouched by the fire. A gate still straddles the road. A lamppost stands tall. Just beyond the guardhouse is the park's activity board. 2-inch plastic letters advertise bingo at 7 p.m. on Tuesdays and ticket sales for Thanksgiving dinner. The only indication of the fire is the top row of plastic letters. They've melted over and look as if they're dripping off the board. It's these community get-togethers that some residents here say they'll miss the most.
This was the Beverly Hills of the mobile home parks, you know?
Ruben Ordaz, a tow truck driver with elaborate arm tattoos, lived here with his mother.
It was beautiful here. Everybody had nice grass, nice trees, nice. Everybody kept their yards clean and houses painted, everything.
The park residents I talked to all said the same thing. People of all stripes lived here. Young, old, white, Latino, Asian, African-American, gay, straight. Even a few rich people, Ruben boasted.
We even had a few millionaires living here. I knew one of them, and people of all sorts, you know. Everybody just got along. That's just the bottom line.
Ruben's sister, Jo Ordaz, is sifting through what used to be the kitchen.
Nothing really. I mean, there's cupcake tins.
She grew up in Sylmar and remembers when the park opened in the late 1970s. That would be a nice place to live, she remembers thinking. A few years ago, when her mother had knee surgery and needed a one-story house, Jo bought her mom a home here.
My mom, when she was healing from her double knee surgery, the guy next door, Gary, we just left the door open all the time, and he'd come and check on her throughout the day.
People walked around, they spoke to each other, they became a family.
Fred Goodman and his partner Dennis Cassidy live next to the Ordazes. He rattles off the social activities at the park. Bingo, of course, old-time movie night, dances. Recently, there was an anniversary party for a couple that's been together 70 years. Fred walks me over to the clubhouse. On the way, we pass the metal frame of a garage that has melted down onto a burned-out car.
You can see the fire hoses from the fire department just melted to the ground.
Hmm. For sale sign here.
This
Somebody
house
didn't quite make it before the fire came.
Good fire sale.
Yeah. You have a good sense of humor about
all
this.
That's all we have to do. This is the clubhouse site. We had voting here. We had a library. We had a huge eating hall, banquet facilities. To the right, outdoor, was a big community barbecue pit, a putting green.
There are a few pieces of blackened gym equipment left standing on a concrete platform. Charred lounge chairs are still neatly arranged around the pool. Up the street from the burned-out clubhouse, Michael Medrano is digging through what looks like a big charcoal pit. He has a bandana tied around his head and streaks of black soot across his face and bare chest. He shows me where his outdoor patio used to be.
And you look up the mountains and there'd be hawks flying and the coyotes come down at night and the bunnies would come down in the early morning hours and eat all your plants. But who gave a rat's, you know? It was wonderful. It was wonderful. Our neighbor across the street, Marge, she's an elderly woman and she made the best cookies.
And every Mother's Day, there was a $5 champagne brunch, Michael remembers with a devilish smile, as if there's a longer story there he might tell you at another time.
It probably will never be the way it was because, you know, most of the seniors here, I think, are going to move on. I think it's just been too traumatic for them.
Do you think you'd like to rebuild right here?
I believe so, yes. Yes, absolutely. It was wonderful. It was a great place to live. It really was.
For the California Report, I'm Sarah Varney.
Losing your home in a wildfire teaches hard lessons about what makes a house vulnerable to fire. The good news for anyone rebuilding or remodeling in a fire zone? There are steps you can take to minimize the danger. KPBS reporter Allison St. John visited a San Diego homeowner who did a lot of research before building her new house.
Workmen are leveling the dirt around Annie Atkins' front door, ready to pour the concrete path that curves around much of her home. The view from the back patio sweeps across a rural valley. She used to have a trailer on the property, but that was before the rice fire burned through last October.
The trailer was sitting right here, and it ended up being a 27-foot garden sculpture. It burned, but my heart goes out to my neighbors. I have five that entirely lost their homes.
Atkins and her husband started building their new home last December. They moved in July, but they've been planning its fire safety features ever since the Cedar Fire swept through San Diego in 2003.
The rooftop is red tile.
Atkins chose her roof carefully. Under every curved tile, she put a bird stop.
It's like a little plug that stops birds from going up and nesting underneath your tile. But it also will stop the little burning bits from blowing in underneath and catching your rooftop on fire.
Under the tile is a heavy tar subsealer that she made sure was flame resistant.
I even took a lighter to it to see if I could catch it, but it never caught flame.
It comes as a surprise to find out the walls of Atkins' house are straw bale. But, she says, unlike the straw bales you see in Western movies, this straw is so compressed there's no oxygen inside for flames to feed on. The bales are coated inside and out with at least half an inch of plaster and stucco.
So you have this fireproof coating over the house. And then the eaves of the house are what are called boxed eaves. And they're stuccoed. There's not any exposed horizontal wood that would support flame.
The straw has an added advantage of helping insulate the house. Atkins goes inside for a moment to hit a switch and demonstrate electric rolling shutters on her windows.
They're more common on the East Coast where they have hurricanes. But in the advent of the fire, we'll drop them down into a closed and locked position, which will prevent any burning embers from bursting the windows by, you know, impact.
Yvette Urea-Moe of the County Office of Emergency Services stopped by to check out some of the features of Atkins' house. She says windows proved to be a vulnerable point for many homes that burned in San Diego last year.
A lot of homes caught fire last year because the winds were so strong that they literally picked up your patio furniture and just blew them into your windows, and that's how homes caught fire.
There is a sprinkler system inside the house, but sprinkler heads are also installed outside along the edge of the roof. Mo says that's another of Atkins' innovative solutions.
She has it hooked up to her above-ground pool. Her pool is up on a hill. And in the event that she had to evacuate, she could just hit a switch and the pool water will start draining into those spigots and it'll protect the exterior of her home.
Outside on the hillside below the pool, Ann Atkins has cut down some old avocado trees, and there are small native shrubs struggling to gain a foothold in the dry dirt.
We have ceanothus, the low-growing coyote bush, which will act as a ground cover, and some manzanita. So as we find different plants that are California natives, we plunk them in.
Atkins does have a bank of green cherimoya trees below the house that got singed but weren't destroyed when the rice fire came through last year. She scans a nearby ridge where the wood frame of a new house stands bare and vulnerable. Below, in the valley, a flag, the Stars and Stripes, waves bravely above a small trailer.
The RVs and trailers you see here, these are people that they once had homes there. So they are living on their property and getting things ready for the rebuild.
Atkins hopes her investment in safer building practices will now pay off in fire seasons to come. For the California Report, I'm Allison St. John in San Diego.
Tell us your thoughts about the California Report, praise or criticism. Send your comments our way by email to calreport@kqed.org. That's calreport@kqed.org. It's also a snap to download our podcast. Just visit us at californiareport.org. Again, our website, californiareport.org. Traditional Thanksgiving cooks will be brining, stuffing, and roasting their way into next week's turkey feast. Foodies looking for a bigger culinary challenge can find it at a San Francisco market, where home cooks can learn to be their own butcher. Lisa Morehouse reports.
Hey, guys.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good. How about you?
Avadanos Holly Park Market is an old-time butcher shop that can make a foodie's heartbeat faster. Customers stop by for lunchtime paninis or stock up on artisan cheeses and charcuterie. They select from restaurant-quality cuts of locally and sustainably raised meat. They can even buy buttons that read, "I love you more than bacon," as if that were possible. And for the really adventurous customer, once a month, Avadanos offers lessons in the art of butchery.
First, we're going to do the pork, or the pig, which is divided into four primals. So you have...
Tia Harrison is one of the three women who co-owns Avadanos. She's the head butcher.
The loin, which is separated into the belly, the loin on the top, and then we have the shoulder, which right behind here we have the skeletal chart, which you can kind of see.
She's talking to a group of four guys wearing white smocks who are here for a butchering workshop. Over the next 3 hours, they'll break down this suckling pig and a lamb carcass, learn about knife skills and cuts of meat, and earn major bragging rights.
Okay, first cut we're gonna make is to remove the head. It's always best to use your knife to kind of cut down to till you get to the bone.
John Jakubowski is the first student to take the knife.
I'm cutting the head off of a pig. Oh, now he's looking at me, great. Hi, bud.
Chris Perry is next with the feet and hocks.
Got it. A little nerve-wracking, the first one, so yeah.
And the group continues, scraping the bone to remove fragments and preserve the meat, sawing through the spine, using a cleaver on the ribs, and tying up the deboned shoulders into neat roasts.
Well, before it kind of looked like a wild animal, and now it looks like something I'd see in a butcher shop. It's all tied up and ready to go.
I see these pre-packaged, you know, meats in the store, and I know there's something more to it than just that, so it's getting to know the whole animal, getting a better idea of the cuts of meat that I regularly eat, seeing the whole process.
That's right in line with the philosophy behind Avadanos. It's been a butcher shop in one form or another since 1901. Along with the usual pork chops and steaks, Avadanos sells whole chickens with heads and feet still attached. Co-owner Angela Wilson says not everyone likes to see that much detail.
I'm like, well, that's a chicken, and that's what they look like, and if you don't like it, then maybe you should be a vegetarian.
They respect meat here. They use whole animals and encourage customers to try new cuts by stocking them in the store and sharing recipes.
So it's just kind of a different way of thinking about food. It's not really easy to find, like, pig butts with the skin on them and all the fat and stuff like that anywhere in town. We sell tubs of lard, and people want tubs of lard. They want duck fat.
Right there. So you can do the same thing, you know, just cut out, score around, get as close to the bone as you can, and then saw it.
By the time they get to the lamb, the guys in class are moving deftly between tools. While it's hanging, Jakubowski separates the lamb between loin and rack, using a hook in the ribs to steady the carcass. Harry uses a cleaver to produce lamb chops.
Proud of my handiwork here. Looks good.
Here we have the loin chops, the rack, the two lamb racks, shoulder roasts.
As Harrison gives each of them a bag full of meat they butchered, Jakubowski says he'll approach future meat purchases with a lot more knowledge.
I think walking out of here, I'm going to know a hell of a lot more than I did walking in, but I'm going to let them do the work because it's a lot of work.
For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse.
If you're inspired to sharpen your butchery skills, we've got a link to Avadanos on our website, californiareport.org. It's a pretty good bet that many Thanksgiving dinners next week will include the appearance of roasted chestnuts. They were popular with Native Americans, and now they're often found in traditional turkey stuffing, vegetable dishes, even soup at this time of year. And here's some good news. If you're into eating locally grown food, California is one of the few places in the United States you can still find chestnut trees. East Coast chestnut trees native to North America died off a century ago, killed off by fungus imported from Asia. Today, just a few American chestnut trees planted far from that infestation still survive. Four types of those, along with Chinese and Italian varieties of the tree, grow on Skyline Chestnut Orchard, a grove perched above the Northern California town of Woodside. As ranch manager Hans Josens explains, the exact origin of the orchard is unknown.
The story that I'm told most consistently and the one that I like the most is that a Spanish man from down in the valley floor moved up here shortly after California was acquired by the United States in 1848. And he brought with him several seedlings and some cuttings and planted them up here on the Skyline Ridge.
Picking season is late fall, and Yosin says Skyline Orchard attracts customers from all over the world.
We have a lot of Italian customers, Portuguese, Spanish, French, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Russian, and most of those that I just named have some sort of a cultural background with chestnuts.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost nipping at your nose.
People always equate the chestnuts with the holidays, especially Christmas, because Mel Torme and chestnuts roasting on an open fire. My preferred way is over the open fire, you know, on a charcoal fire.
That worked out perfectly.
Did it?
If you're tempted to go straight to the source for your chestnuts, there's good news and bad. First, the good news. Chestnut picking is something of a contradiction in terms, since ripe chestnuts actually fall to the ground. Picking them up is easy. The hard part, getting to the actual nut meat, because they're covered in a sheath of sharp burrs. You want to avoid getting stuck by one of those protective needles. And Hans Josens has some advice.
You got to be careful there with your shoes. It's one thing that I always recommend is people wear hiking outdoor footwear. I just violated one of my cardinal rules is never come back here without gloves and a bucket, because there's invariably you're going to see some on the ground and you just can't help yourself but pick them up.
Skyline's customers are happy to offer up suggestions for cooking chestnuts. Ben Asaro of Foster City, California, suggested this recipe from his Italian aunt.
You toast them in the oven till the skins curl, and then put them in a basket with a towel and pour red wine over it and let them steam. And that's it.
One other thing about chestnuts, they don't sell for peanuts. Make sure you bring lots of cash. Chestnuts cost $5.25 a pound, and they're heavier than they look.
We should have stopped at the bank before we came. I got those two checks to cash.
I thought you had cash.
Or sticking with your plans of 2 pounds.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So, how much do I owe you? 40?
42, yes.
Despite the high price and the sinking economy, chestnut pickers were out in droves this year. In fact, Skyline Chestnut Orchard is expecting to be sold out of chestnuts as early as today. So, if you're planning to make a visit, be sure to call first. For more information about the orchard, visit our website, californiareport.org. The litter you see blowing around your street or neighborhood is more than just annoying. Some of it, especially plastic, is having disastrous effects in the ocean. Carried off by storm runoff to a giant watery pit of litter off the coast of California, the North Pacific Gyre, as it's called, is a floating collection of trash the size of Texas. This week, the State Ocean Protection Council took a series of steps aimed at limiting the amount of plastic we use. David Gorn reports.
Hannah Rose Nevins is a researcher at Moss Landing Marine Laboratories. Today, she's in Santa Cruz working the necropsy lab. She steps into a huge walk-in freezer to pluck a frozen seabird off the shelves and then hefts the large carcass onto an examining table. And starts to tear away the rigid plastic wrapping.
Last year we got about 200 samples, and those all came from the Beachcombers Beach Survey Program.
Nevins is checking the stomach contents of each of these birds, which are called fulmars and look similar to seagulls, to see if she finds any plastic inside them. So far, she says, she's found an average of about 15 pieces of plastic in the bellies of most of the birds she's investigated. And in some of them, she says, she's found as much as 120 bits of plastic jammed and pressed into a bird's stomach the size of a walnut.
So there's a piece of line plastic, so there's red, and pinks, and blues.
That much plastic may be dangerous for the bird, she says. But she's not investigating what plastic does to these birds.
Our study is mainly focusing on not the population level impacts, but how we can use the birds as samplers of the marine environment.
Nevins is using the fulmar stomachs as indicators of just how much plastic pollution is out in the ocean. And there's a lot of it, says John Fentis, looking out over the harbor in Long Beach. Most of the plastic in the northern Pacific, more than 3 million tons of it, he says, comes from land litter, much of it carried by stormwater runoff into the sea.
Plastic will collect in this area called the North Pacific Gyre.
Fentis is president of the Algalita Marine Research Foundation, which first discovered the concentration of garbage about 1,000 miles offshore in the Pacific Gyre, a swirling vortex of trash at least the size of Texas. Fentis says it's not just the size of the gyre that's such a danger. It's more the density of the amount of plastic found in the water. He holds up a thick sample of what the water looks like out in the gyre.
This is a jar that, as you can see, is filled with plastic pieces and a kind of a soupy mixture, part of which is plankton. This is more like a synthetic soup.
The plastic breaks down into such small bits that researchers can't strain it out of the water, so it's almost impossible to clean up. Birds and fish mistake it for food, and the plastic ends up in their stomachs. And that could end up in our stomachs, according to University of California at Irvine biomedical researcher Bruce Bromberg. Some chemicals in the plastic, he says, can make their way into the tissue of the fish we eat. The possible endocrine disruptors in plastic, he says, could be hazardous.
Is ingesting plastic acutely toxic at the levels that we see it, and is it going to kill us? Probably not in the short term, but is it causing long-term damage? I would say that the data are pretty strong that it is.
The plastics industry maintains that plastics are safe and that one of the solutions for all of that marine debris is a stronger recycling effort. But Dustin McDonald of the environmental group Surfrider Foundation says that not all plastic can be easily recycled, and much of it breaks into small pieces that can't be managed.
Trying to clean up polystyrene on a beach is like trying to filter the Sahara Desert. You just can't do it.
McDonald sees the same thing over and over during his beach cleanups in the tourist town of Capitola, population 9,000, just south of Santa Cruz. Tiny bits of plastic everywhere you look. So Capitola, he says, was one of the first in the state to pass a ban on polystyrene. Those are the to-go containers for leftovers from restaurants, styrofoam cups, and the hard plastic lids from coffee houses.
Polystyrene's a big problem because once it's being used in a food environment, it's food contaminated and there's no way to recycle it. And that's the real reason why food vendors themselves are the ones that have been targeted by this particular ban.
The idea, McDonald says, is to stop the flow of plastic before it can get into the water and onto the beaches. On Thursday, a state panel agreed. The Ocean Protection Council is now making three recommendations. Manufacturers of those clamshell to-go containers must be willing to take back and recycle those containers. A fee may be assessed on some plastics, like those flimsy plastic bags in supermarkets. And businesses using plastic-lined coffee cups and styrofoam juice cups would be required to use non-plastic alternatives, if they're available. For the California Report, I'm David Gorn.
And to see the plasticky images behind this story, head to our website, you probably know it by now, californiareport.org. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. The director is Nina Thorson. Tom Krimkowski is the technical producer. We had additional engineering from Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. Our interns are Catherine Castleman, Darlene Bouchard, and Heather Gilligan, who produced our visit to the Skyline Chestnut Farm. The online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Susie Rocho is our producer. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Andrea Kissick was a contributing editor. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, sponsoring the James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards, with nomination information online at www.irvine.org. Chevron, an energy company founded in California more than 125 years ago, helping fuel California's way of life. More information is available at chevron.com. And the California Endowment, working to build healthier communities that support children, youth, and families. Online at www.calendow.org.